Good evening and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz and I'll be your host this evening when we talk about diet. It is estimated that around 45 million people in the United States go on a diet each year, with weight loss being the primary goal. However, whether you're dieting to lose weight or simply to improve overall health, sticking to a specific eating plan can be very challenging. But even if weight loss isn't your goal, improving your diet may greatly benefit your health in other ways. Your risk of developing such diseases as diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, dementia, and even certain types of cancer can be reduced by modifying what you eat. Dietary modification can also help manage many of these conditions as well. But with so many diets to choose from, how can you tell which one will work for you? Well, tonight, we will attempt to answer some of those questions and discuss the various types of diets available. And with me this evening, I have a number of specialists who are going to help. We are very fortunate this evening to have Julie Hartley, who is a registered dietitian and certified health coach and a functional medicine specialist. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
We also have Dr. Jennifer Singh, who's board certified in lifestyle medicine, as well as internal medicine and pediatrics, and who serves as the director of lifestyle medicine at Feist-Weiler Cancer Center at LSU Health in Shreveport. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Ken Sanders is a board certified otolaryngologist, head and neck surgeon, and specializes in facial plastic surgery and sleep medicine. And Dr. Laura Kimball Rivari is an endocrinologist and director of Willis-Knighton Endocrine and Thyroid Specialists. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we have a very big topic to discuss this evening. I want to let everyone know that this is a live show this evening, and we welcome your calls at 800-552-8502. Please call in a question for our guests, and if you'd like, you can just, if you don't want to go on the air, just let the person answering the phone know what your question is, and they can send it to me here in the booth. So to start off, Julie, let's talk about some basics. You know, people hear about carbs and protein and fats. What are these things and what distinguishes them from each other?
All right, that's just a great question. And again, we need to get back to the basics. But, you know, what carbohydrates, protein, and fats are what we call macronutrients. So these are just fuels that our body needs to, you know, to do our activities of daily living. This is how our brain works, how our heart functions. And so we need these types of proteins and carbohydrates and fats in our diet in order just to fuel our body.
So what is a carbohydrate specifically?
So a carbohydrate, you know, comes from all different kinds of foods. So donuts could be a carbohydrate, but then also, you know, broccoli is also a carbohydrate. So it's a lot of diversity. So it's just really, you know, the what the main fuel source is of that particular food.
But ultimately, it's sugar in a various form.
Oh, absolutely, yes. They all will end up breaking down to different forms of sugar.
So sugar ultimately, or perhaps starches, mm-hmm. things of that sort, or carbohydrates, and they can be found in various foods.
Sure. And then so there's others. So there are still even other fuel sources that even will eventually break down. Fats break down. Carbohydrates break down. Alcohol is another fuel source. We don't highly recommend mm-hmm. it, but it is still a fuel source. Ketones are, you know, a fuel source. And they will all break down into, you know, what we call acetyl-CoA that enters, you know, a metabolic cycle called the Krebs cycle.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, we won't get all into, you know, into that. But yes, they all essentially the basics, they are fuel.
And it's a matter of what your diet is composed of, how much of each that you get.
Absolutely.
Okay. We have a call already. This is Leon from Bossier City. Let's get him, Leon, on the phone. Leon, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I've got a question about organic, raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar.
Okay. What specifically is your question, Leon?
As it is a health benefit or not.
Okay, Julie, you want to take it?
I'm actually a big fan of raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar. It is a fermented food, so we know that it gives our body much-needed probiotics, and it has a lot of, you know, health benefits, so I do highly recommend it. There has been some studies where it can actually lower blood sugar and, you know, can have a fat-burning effect for a lot of people. We can't eat donuts and pizza and take apple cider vinegar and expect it to be a magic pill, but within a context context of a healthy diet, it certainly can be added benefits. And so you want to, I do want to distinguish, there is a difference between the raw and filtered fermented ones and then just basic apple cider vinegar.
What does it do?
The apple cider vinegar, so yeah. Just the fermented, you know, process provides the probiotics. It helps heal the gut. It,
okay.
You know, so there's a lot. It has an alkaline effect on the blood and can actually stunt, you know, carbohydrate uptake as well, too, so which can benefit the blood sugar.
Okay, very good. Leon, thank you. Does that answer your question?
It does indeed.
Perfect.
Thank you all for a wonderful program.
Oh, thank you for calling in.
About 2 tablespoons, Leon. About 2 tablespoons with water is kind of a good therapeutic dose.
Perfect. Okay, so you mentioned again, you mentioned the word carbohydrates again. I want to get back to that a little bit. Now, there's complex carbohydrates, simple carbohydrates, and then there's fiber too, which I guess is carbohydrates that aren't really, I guess would you consider them carbohydrates that aren't really digested, right?
Absolutely.
And that's fiber. So can you talk a little bit about the difference between them? There's also a term you hear a lot of, glycemic index. And how that relates to the simple and the complex. Can you kind of help us figure out the difference between all these things?
Well, it's interesting that it's called complex carbohydrates, right? Because the topic can get to be complex. But really what it is that it's just more sugar molecules, you know, hooked together when it's complex. And those are what we consider starchy foods. And again, those can come from things like bread, or they can come from things like starchy vegetables like sweet potatoes, versus what we consider simple carbohydrates, which, again, would come from simple sugars, you know, just like added sugars or, you know, drinks that like fruit, you know, fruit juice would have some of those. And then, you know, what we consider fiber in those foods, again, like you mentioned, it is part of the carbohydrates, but it's one that's not digested, so it's not taken into the carbohydrate uptake. It doesn't really have an effect on the calorie levels or the carbohydrate levels, but it does make a difference to the body. We need, you know, different kinds of fiber. It makes difference on cholesterol and digestion and those kinds of things.
It can actually slow the absorption of the other carbohydrates.
Absolutely.
The more simple carbohydrates, and also help to help move things along.
Absolutely. So it's what we call, you know, soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. Right. Both are very, very important.
Okay. So, Dr. Kim Barari, as an endocrinologist, I imagine you see lots of diabetes.
Yes.
Okay. And I know that sugar has something to do with diabetes. Can you explain a little bit what diabetes is, and then what role sugar and insulin and how they relate to each other in the treatment and of that disease?
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, it's really on a whole continuum now, because we have, you know, close to 30 million Americans that have diabetes now, and there's, you know, close to, you know, 9 million out there that don't even know they have it, that are borderline or insulin resistant. And I think it's important for the audience to understand, you know, a normal functioning pancreas and normal use of insulin and glucose, opposed to someone that, you know, is pre-diabetic, because you really just don't go to bed one day and wake up the next day and you're diabetic. And so it's this whole topic of insulin resistance or impaired glucose tolerance. So it's not all, we're trying to catch patients before they get to that diabetic, you know, actually before they actually develop diabetes.
So what exactly is abnormal in someone who has diabetes?
Well, we have a normal level of blood glucose, and a normal level of blood glucose in a fasting state would be less than 100.
Glucose being sugar.
And then the diagnosis of diabetes is when the fasting blood sugar is greater than 126 in a fasting state, or if it's greater than 200 at a random time throughout the day. And so what happens is, you know, Julie was talking about glucose as the body's fuel. And so when you eat your carbohydrates and you metabolize it and, you know, you have glucose, there's got to be a way that you get glucose into the cell, because that is your body's fuel. So how do you get it into the cell? And that's where insulin comes along. And you need insulin. Insulin is a hormone that's made by the pancreas that is on, you know, the receptors of cells, and you try, or has a receptor to accept that insulin and then take in signal to get that glucose into the cell. So you've got to have enough insulin to get the body's fuel into the cell to use it for your brain, your heart, your gut, the rest of, you know, muscles, for the rest of your body. And when you don't have enough insulin, functioning insulin working, you can't utilize your body's glucose, your body's fuel source, effectively or efficiently. So you want to make sure that you have enough insulin. And if you don't, you can build up insulin resistance. And so when you're not able to make enough insulin to utilize your glucose, you develop diabetes. And so that's where all the medicines are, you know, targeted.
So there are different types of diabetes, though, right?
Right. There's type 1 and type 2. Type 1 diabetes is where usually you get diagnosed during the pediatric or adolescent years, but I've diagnosed patients in their 40s and 50s that have type 1 diabetes. This is autoimmune. This is essentially where you have an autoimmune defect where you destroy the beta cells in your pancreas, and over time you destroy all of those cells and you cannot make insulin.
So you're not making the insulin.
You are not making insulin. Opposed to a type 2 diabetic that is insulin resistant would be the term that we would use.
Okay, so if someone's they don't make the insulin, then they have to get insulin from somewhere.
Correct.
So they get, okay. And then if they make insulin but they're resistant to the insulin, so it's not working well to bring the sugar into the cells, what can happen?
Well, your blood sugar would go up.
And then what happens?
And then you start having complications with, your blood sugar goes up. You don't feel well, first of all. Normally, you start getting having thirst, a lot of thirst. You get very thirsty. You get very hungry because you're not utilizing the glucose. And so when you're not utilizing glucose, you end up urinating that glucose out. So you're losing a lot of your calories by doing that. So your blood sugar is going up. And then when you have your blood sugar going up, then you start having complications of the blood sugar that causes all the complications of diabetes, like, you know, damage to the eyes, damage to the kidneys, damage to the nerves, the heart. And so you have further complications. So that's where we get medication started.
So it affects the blood vessels, I guess,
right,
all these different
absolutely
things.
So, okay, absolutely. Okay. But when when someone gets diagnosed with diabetes or even borderline diabetic, we first start to talk about lifestyle modification to hopefully prevent them from even needing medication.
Yeah. So a lot of times people who have diabetes also deal with being overweight. Is it that the diabetes causes them to gain weight, or is it the insulin that causes them to gain weight, or is it the fact that they may have too much weight that makes them resistant to the insulin?
Like, that's a very good question.
How is that related?
And really, it's the increased weight that is leading to insulin resistance. Though in just very plain terms, the fat cells work against insulin. You build up this insulin resistance where your insulin is not working efficiently, where you might, on a lower bar, someone that doesn't have insulin would be at a lower bar, okay? And if you have insulin resistance, that just basically means that your body's not able to use that insulin effectively. So the bar is raised. It's kind of like raises a threshold at which at what point you need insulin. So you when you would normally eat a small meal, you would utilize that glucose and take it up into the cell. But if you have prediabetes or insulin resistance, your bar is set really high. So your pancreas has to work that much harder to make that much more insulin to get over that bar to use it effectively.
Now, I understand that insulin also kind of inhibits the breakdown of fat in your body. So it almost makes you hold on to your fat, or maybe even promotes more fat deposition. Is that correct?
Right, because you're not utilizing it. You're not able to utilize that food source and utilize it and get into the cells and use it.
Got
so
it.
Then when you don't do that, then you store it as glycogen.
So it sounds like we want to have our insulin work as well as possible so we don't need any more of it than absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
And if we can keep a healthy weight, then we can help our insulin work well and help and not get into that cycle where we're overweight, the insulin isn't working well, so now we're more likely to gain more weight. Where does diet fit in?
Oh, it fits in right at the very beginning. I mean, that's the first thing that has to be discussed, because limiting your sugar intake, limiting your carbohydrates will lower your insulin requirements, first of all. And so you won't have to, when you're eating less, you're taking in less carbohydrates, you're not going to require as much insulin. So that's, insulin, weight loss, exercise, lifestyle modification. I mean, we just, we preach that every day with our pre-diabetics and our diabetics, that has got to be, that's key. To treat.
So is there a qualitative difference between the carbohydrates that somebody with, let's say, diabetes has, or somebody who has a problem with their blood sugar than somebody who, let's say, who doesn't? I understand there's a specific diabetic diet that's recommended. What kind of, how is it different than what other people who are not diabetic may eat?
Well, I think, you know, if you don't have that, if you don't have effective insulin molecules or hormones working, you're not going to be able to metabolize that sugar. Okay. And so whereas someone could, you know, sit and eat a, you know, all carbohydrates are not created equal, just like Julie said, you know, a donut or an apple, you know, just common sense tells you that it would be better to eat that apple, a good carbohydrate, than eating a bad carbohydrate. So that's where we kind of have to, you know, start at the basic.
Now, the difference between those, I understand, is fiber. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I think we were talking about before. But now, what about starchy foods and things of that sort? Are those problematic for people with diabetes?
Absolutely, because you're going to have increase your insulin requirements. You're going to increase that insulin requirement. If you're not able to metabolize that food, you're not able to do it. You're going to have some help with some medication along the line.
Okay, so we obviously would like to save medication for second choice. All right.
Yes.
So can you give me an idea of like certain like a diet for a diabetic, like on a percentage basis?
Sure.
Like,
you asked that. What was the diabetic diet? You know, we traditionally we don't really, you know, the American Diabetes Association and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, they're the ones that have the guidelines of what we follow, or the USDA, the healthyplate.gov. And so basically when I talk to a patient about a diabetic diet, I use the healthy plate, and you know, half of that plate should be green leafy vegetable, non-starchy vegetables. A quarter of that should be the protein source, and then a quarter of that plate could be the, you know, more of a starchy carb, and then, you know, a fruit, and then, you know, a dairy, and then, you know, oils. And so we have, you know, all that listed out. We hand our patients, and we usually refer them to a dietitian or nutritionist to get further education on that. But it's overall, it's limitation of carbohydrates. It's not overloading, because that's where the carbohydrates or where the problem is with the diet.
And does it matter if those carbohydrates are absorbed quickly or slowly?
Well, it's actually, well, looking at simple and, you know, simple and complex carbohydrates, it's much better to eat the more complex carbohydrate if you're in limiting, opposed to saying eating a candy bar or eating some, you know, crackers and cheese or something like that. For metabolism, you definitely want to slow it down.
Okay. All right. So, Dr. Singh. Yes. I understand that you are a strong proponent of primarily a vegetarian or vegetable-based diet. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So for our listeners, could you describe the different types of vegetable-type diets?
Yes. Very confusing. Well, actually, I could even be confused. So I'll describe it in a way that I think simplifies it. I actually steer clear of the terms vegan, vegetarian, lacto-ovo-vegetarian. Because, number one, they're confusing, and many of those terms make people feel that they are adopting an entire new way of thinking about the world, and it's really much more scientific than that. I like to use the word plant-based or plant-strong, because it simply describes what I'm trying to crowd onto my plate, not necessarily what I'm trying to make a statement that I'm against. What I'm for is lots of vegetables, fruits, things that grow from the ground. And if we look at the healthiest populations on the planet, they actually do consume small amounts of animal protein and meat. So plant-based, plant-strong doesn't imply absolutism. It implies modeling after these cultures that we've looked at to learn, wow, they're really having good health outcomes. These people are, you know, millions of them are living to be in their 80s with no cancer and no coronary disease and no diabetes. And here we are spending billions on healthcare every year, and we can't seem to mount these kind of health outcomes. So some of what we know about food, we learn from watching these cultures. So that was a rather long explanation.
No, it's a good explanation.
I like plant-based.
Okay, plant-based.
Yes.
Now, what are some of the health benefits? I know you said, you know, specific, you know, these diseases and things, but
sure,
what specific diseases and health can it help, and what health benefits specifically mm-hmm. do you think that a plant-based diet can offer somebody?
Well, of course, like everyone who is a proponent of some sort of lifestyle change in order to fix disease, I think that it fixes almost everything, like most people do, who whatever it is they promote. And so I can tell you what some of the research shows. The fact is that just about any approach to weight loss will work in the short term. Just about any approach. You can help people lose weight, or they can lose weight on their own in the short term. Losing weight is not as challenging as keeping weight off. And the fact is that the vast majority of interventions, including whole foods plant-based, as well as just about as well as every other intervention that's available, we have not yet conquered the long-term solution to weight loss on a population scale. There will always be exceptions to that. And thankfully, I know people who have beat those odds, as well as everyone at the table knows someone who has kept weight off for a long period of time doing a certain method. So that's great. There is hope.
Okay. Now, some of the vegetarians, I know when you say vegetarian or plant-based, or I don't want to use the wrong term,
sure.
But you know, looking at some of the studies, it seems as though, you know, there's different types of vegetarian, and I'm going to use the term vegetarian because that's how it's used in literature. But there are different types of vegetarians. There are vegetarians who may eat no meat or cheese or milk, but yet they're eating a lot of processed foods.
Right.
They're eating a lot of pasta, a lot of, you know, we mentioned donuts earlier. But yeah, okay, so technically they're not eating animal-based foods, but that's far from healthy. Whereas there are other vegetarians who are eating more of a plant-based diet, like you said. And, and actually, when I was preparing for the show, I looked at some of the literature, and in fact, it did support what you were saying in terms of people losing weight on a plant-based diet and or vegetarian diet, and you know, less cardiovascular disease. But it seemed as though when they really teased it out, it was primarily those vegetarians who were eating truly plants and not processed foods.
Which is why I love the term whole foods plant strong or plant based instead of vegetarian. You can be vegetarian and be eating sort of a Dorito and Dr. Pepper diet, which does not promote good health outcomes. And sorry to go back quickly to a question you asked just a few minutes ago. You were talking specifically what health conditions has this been shown to be good for. So again, weight loss, but honestly, truthfully, in the short term, everyone can claim that weight losses can be achieved. This diet, what drew me to it was specifically its power against the number one killer of Americans, which is coronary disease. So although not every single approach has been tested, the whole foods plant-based approach has been tested specifically in coronary disease, and so far is the only intervention that was shown to actually reverse coronary disease and decrease the diameter of coronary lesions. On, you know, visual, they would do the test where you can actually see. So that was very intriguing to me. Of course, all of the risk factors for coronary disease, hypertension, high cholesterol, can be adjusted with a whole foods plant-based diet, again, as it can with many conditions that promote, or many diets that promote weight loss.
Yeah. So less diabetes and some of the other diseases associated with it. One thing I thought was interesting, it seemed as though the plant-based diet actually lowered it lowered the LDL cholesterol, but didn't necessarily elevate the HDL cholesterol, which I understand is actually, now the thinking is that perhaps it's actually the HDL and total cholesterol ratio rather than the LDL specifically. And that's kind of turning things on its head now.
True.
Go ahead.
Look, just interestingly, the average cholesterol of plant-based eaters in old societies or in primitive cultures who are eating true plant-based diets, sort of the hunter-gatherer almost way of life, average cholesterol in those populations tends to run around 150 to 160. So it is true they also have very low HDLs. And the thought is that once you drop an LDL and a total cholesterol down to a certain level, as you know, the HDL is known as the good cholesterol. And the job of that one is to sort of be the dump truck that takes away some of the cholesterol and dumps it out. As the total cholesterol and bad cholesterol drops, you don't need as many dump trucks. And so in these populations who have low cholesterol and low cardiovascular disease, they have low HDLs, and it's thought that their bodies don't need the dump trucks to get rid of the extra LDL.
So you're talking about these primitive cultures. Dr. Sanders, I want to bring you into the conversation because I understand you're
I'm primitive.
You're a little more primitive.
Yeah,
you're a little more primitive. But when we talk about primitive cultures, I mean, we can go back really far before, I guess, we had farming. Industrial farming, or I guess farming was the beginning of civilization. So the uncivilized human wasn't exactly eating necessarily this plant-based diet to the same degree. Would you say that would be fair?
I think that's what we understand.
Okay.
The plant-based diet that, or the, even the vegetables that I eat in my keto diet, would be they weren't around. You know, we've made these organisms. We bred them to be sweet or colorful or have a bigger rind or have no seeds and things like this. So the vegetables that we eat today just didn't exist back in the days of the primitive humans you're talking about. There were some seeds maybe, there were some grasses they could eat and maybe some fruit, but very little of what we eat today was even around. If you just Google for images of, you know, a primitive peach or banana and look at it, it looks completely different than what we would have today.
And they were seasonal too.
They were very seasonal, and so we were basically starving all winter, you know, or living off of our fat stores that we put on during the summer and the spring. They were very seasonal. So you had me on, I guess, to talk about this more primitive diet, the ketogenic diet.
Well, you mentioned keto. Could you describe a little bit what a ketogenic diet is?
So the ketogenic diet is simply a very low-carb diet. Typically, if you're familiar with counting macros, which is a very popular thing these days, it would be definitely less than 50 grams of carbs a day and probably less than even 30 grams of carbs a day. So that's a very low-carb diet. Very, very different than most Americans eat.
Would that be less, Dr. Singh, than what a person with typical plant-based diet would be eating?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So typically, you know, the standard American diet, as at least as what's recommended, is 55 to 60% carbohydrates, and probably most Americans are eating 70% or 80% carbohydrates, and a lot of those are trash carbohydrates. A lot of that is sugar and high fructose corn syrup poisons. So ketogenic diet is a low-carb diet, and then with a moderate protein, therefore what's left is fat. So we eat a lot of fat, and by fat I mean healthy fats. It can be avocados, oils, yes, definitely meats, fatty meats. Bacon is on the diet. I eat a lot of bacon, cheese, dairy products, eggs. Things that are higher saturated fats.
So what's the rationale behind eating a keto diet as opposed to other types of diet?
So it goes back to a lot of what Dr. Kim O'Rourke was talking about. The carbohydrates, first of all, when Julie was talking about the macronutrients, one of the facts I think we need to put out there is that there's no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. There are essential proteins. There are some essential fatty acids that we have to have fats. But really, you know, someone could live perfectly fine the rest of their life without ever eating any carbohydrates. I mean, you could have zero and be just fine. Your body can make all the sugar it needs to make from things like protein and fats. So that's an important fact. I know I hear that a lot in my patients asking me, well, I have to have some carbs, don't I? I have to have some. And you just truly do not. The other thing is the ketogenic diet is really used for two things. One, weight loss, fat loss. That's a big draw. People Google it, look for it, talk to me about it to lose weight. The other thing is chronic disease reversal. So me and my partner that deal with this on our side jobs, you know, I'm a facial plastic surgeon. He's a urologist. And we take people with type 2 diabetes and reverse that simply by reducing the carbohydrate intake. As Dr. Kim O'Rourke said, and you said, the problem is carbohydrates. So a very simple analogy is to think about, and we tell our patients this, if you have a sink, if I turn the water on the sink and plug the drain and just let it run, it's going to spill over onto the floor. Should I go get a mop and start mopping the floor to fix that problem? Or should I turn off the faucet, you know? So if we cut the carbs for these people, the carbs are the problem. We cut them down very low, and all of a sudden, they're off of their metformin. They're off of their insulin. You know, they're losing weight because their insulin levels are starting to drop, and now they're not inhibiting that fat breakdown you were talking about earlier. They can actually burn fat.
But there's a fundamental difference, it sounds like, because what Dr. Singh was talking about, people are losing weight. So as Dr. Kim O'Rourke was saying, now their insulin resistance has perhaps gone away or it's gotten a lot better. So they're using – their insulin is working better. It's driving the glucose into the cells.
It's not that it's working any better initially. That might happen over long periods of time. They don't need insulin because they're not taking in carbohydrates.
Well, no, I'm just talking about with the plant-based diet.
Oh, okay.
So with the plant-based diet, they're losing the weight. Their insulin is now working better, and you don't have the extra insulin being secreted so it doesn't, you know, inhibit fat breakdown. But what you're talking about is actually having less carbohydrate in the first place so you don't even secrete the insulin. Is that true?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. That's so basically it. You would obviate the need for insulin, and so their insulin resistance becomes much less of a problem.
Because you don't need it as much.
And okay. Over time, that can reverse.
Okay. And you mentioned, we have another caller. This is Bob calling in from, where's he calling from? I don't know where he's from. How do you say it? Joaquin, Texas. Okay.
Joaquin,
Texas. Joaquin. Bob, welcome to Health Matters.
Joking.
Are you there?
Yep, we're there.
I have a set of two questions. What are the causes and prognosis for chronic pancreatitis and the relationship of the gallbladder to the pancreas and pancreatitis? Second question is, are there some sugars besides glucose that a diabetic can eat without any ill effects? And I will hang up and listen to your answers on the radio.
Fantastic. Thanks for your call, Bob. Dr. Kim Bravari, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I can start with that. I think the question was, what are the causes of acute and chronic pancreatitis? And there are many. And some of the most common causes for acute pancreatitis is gallbladder disease with gallstones or an inflammation with what we call cholecystitis and or alcoholism. Alcoholism can cause significant alcohol abuse can affect the pancreas and cause inflammation in the pancreas. And your pancreas does so many things. And, you know, not only just making insulin, but also making glucagon, with the hormone that your body calls upon when your blood sugar gets too low. You need a rescue from that low, as well as some of the digestive enzymes that digest your food. There's an exocrine, what we call an exocrine function of the pancreas, and also an endocrine function of the pancreas. And I focus mostly on the endocrine function of the pancreas with insulin and glucagon, but pancreatitis would be the gallbladder disease and alcohol. Chronic pancreatitis could be someone that has, an alcoholic that is chronically drinking, and the alcohol damages the pancreas. There can be some genetic disorders that cause different dysfunction of the pancreas. But we see a lot with relating the gallbladder with secreting different enzymes and bile. It helps digest your food, and when you have problems or blockage in the gallbladder, with such as a gallstone or a diseased gallbladder, that gets backed up and then affects problems in the pancreas, and you have just kind of a complex state right there that can be very painful and require hospitalization a lot of times, and even surgery.
Hmm. Very good. Julie, I wanted to ask you something to follow up what Dr. Sanders was saying. He was talking about that ketogenic diet and fats, saturated fats. In fact, I think he said that the majority of the calories came from fat. Now, the current guidelines, nutrition guidelines, I think, limit fats. And perhaps they also distinguish between saturated, unsaturated fats and things of that sort. There's saturated fats, unsaturated, hydrogenated, you've got trans fats. And then can you talk a little bit about the different types of fats, perhaps which ones are considered more healthy or unhealthy?
Certainly. And that's, one of the things that we've learned over the past couple of decades is, the diet pendulum tends to swing one way or the other. One of the macronutrients, back when in the 80s was fat. And so we thought a little fat is bad. And then we went all the way to fat is the complete enemy. And so we know we really missed out on a lot of healthy fats like avocados, essential fatty acids, those types of things. And so adding those back in healthy amounts is certainly something that we have learned, in some of the research today. So we do have saturated fats. They do occur naturally. Some of those mostly are in meat products, animal products that we see. And then, of course, hydrogenated fats, and trans fats, as you mentioned, just like Dr. Sanders was talking about, a lot of junk, in our diet, a lot of processed foods in our diet. And these are more man-made fats, hydrogenated oils are in lots of our products that really are unhealthy that we're trying to get out. So, those, and then, you have essential fats that you absolutely, they're essential because we have to get them, our body can't make them, so we have to get them from our foods. And so that's why you hear a lot about omega-3 fatty acids, through fish products and those kinds of things too.
Now, I understand that recent research is actually suggesting that these saturated fats may not, in fact, be bad for you and may, in fact, be healthy, particularly when it comes to cardiovascular disease and reducing cardiovascular disease. We talked about the good cholesterol, and it seems as though now some of the studies coming out suggest that people who are eating more protein, less carbohydrate, are actually having an increase in their good cholesterol and perhaps having lower rates of cardiovascular disease. Dr. Sanders, do you want to comment on that?
So, yeah, in general, we like to talk about saturated fats as healthy fats. It's the unsaturated portions that are allowing for cellular damage and then further on into plaque formation. So we talk about saturated fats as being a healthy fat, whether that saturated fat is animal or plant-based. So when it comes to a saturated fat, somebody can look at a fat in a lot of cases and tell if it's saturated. If it's solid at room temperature, typically that's a saturated fat. So the bacon grease your grandmother had on the back of the stove, that's a saturated fat. An avocado is very high in saturated fat. It's solid. The oils, the corn oils, the things you were mentioning before, very unhealthy in my opinion. These things are unsaturated and polyunsaturated, and these are liquid at room temperature. An exception would be maybe olive oil. That's obviously a great oil, and it's, you know, of course, liquid. MCT oil, which is medium chain triglyceride oil, that's a very healthy fat, and obviously it's a liquid at room temperature.
And what about coconut oil?
Coconut oil as well. It's kind of in the middle, isn't it? As soon as you touch it, it melts. So it's kind of somewhere in the middle of room temperature, solid or not.
Okay. So there's some disagreement because the research is a little conflicting.
Well,
I guess.
I think that the disagreement on my part is going to come when we talk about guidelines.
Yeah.
Okay. These guidelines that have been out for 50 years, and in my opinion, they're just flat wrong. I think they're 100% wrong. These guidelines have done nothing but increase obesity and type 2 diabetes in this country by fourfold in the past 30 years.
I want to get to those guidelines in just a second. Okay. We have a caller, but that's a really important point. I definitely want to get to that. So if I forget, please remind me. Okay, we have David from Minden. David, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. My question for your panel is, what specific foods are linked to cancer? And what about foods that supposedly have known carcinogens like bacon, sausage, processed meats, hot dogs, things of that nature? What's your panel's view on those type foods?
Dr. Singh?
Thank you. Great question. I work at the Cancer Center in Shreveport, and so one of the things that I do is help people, counsel them with the current best science that we know to date on what they can do to nutritionally hopefully lower their chance of cancer as much as possible, as well as a recurrence. So yes, it was. It is concerning that the World Health Organization issued a scientific paper a couple of years ago in The Lancet, which is one of the most respected journals in the scientific literature, declaring that processed meats, and so yes, that includes bacon, ham, sausage, and even lunch meats, actually are class one carcinogens according to their definition. Now, just to show you a little bit of weight to that, that's the same thing that they declare cigarettes to be. So, you know, granted, I'm sure that should we dig deep enough, any of us can find a scientific article that declares the opposite of what I just said. So just remember that scientific evidence is always varied, but based on the mountain of evidence that they could put together, they felt strongly enough about it to declare that it is, in fact, cancer-causing. And they went so far as to say that red meat is most likely cancer-causing in humans. So I'm concerned about any dietary approach that features this, even if there's a question about it being cancer-causing as the primary portion of, you know, the dietary plate.
And Dr. Singh, I think specifically, I think it was colorectal cancer that they were talking about. David, I am my part time. I'm also a cancer doctor myself, and there actually are some associations between prostate cancer, breast cancer, and
dairy,
and well, fat, but primarily it's processed foods. Being overweight, there's some suggestion that high fat diet could contribute to those as well.
Well, and to bring it all back around to diabetes,
right.
You know, the insulin resistance is also strongly linked to cancer risk as well as risk of recurrence of cancer, yet another reason to try to get a handle on those insulin receptors.
So in both of those cases, whether you're talking about the processed foods or you're talking about, and I guess when I said fat, I think it's mostly trans fats, but the processed foods and even the processed meats, like you mentioned, salami, lunch meats, bacon, things of that sort. It's interesting that, the word processed comes in. And so then the question is, does that necessarily apply to non-processed meats? Now, and also it's how these meats are prepared, too, because there are some suggestion that maybe grilling meats add some carcinogen to it. And so it's a pretty complex, it's a complex issue. And so these recommendations and the research is constantly changing. And I think you really raise a very good question, and I want to continue after you hang up, David. Dr. Sanders, you were talking about the guidelines. Okay, you want to continue what you were saying about the guidelines, and you think they're outdated or 50 years out?
Well, I think they're just inherently
wrong. Thank you, David, by the way.
There's the reason, you know, our guidelines are what they are. The FDA guidelines, the food pyramid, started back in the 70s, I think it was. There was a researcher named Ansel Keys who did a 23-country study, and when he found that what he wanted to prove was that fat was bad, and the 23 countries didn't show that, so he threw 15 of them out and put 7 or 8 together, and then that did show fat was bad and got in front of Congress, and that became our guidelines. So the guidelines that we that I learned as a child, you know, the bottom of the pyramid is carbohydrates and rice and pasta and all this, and the top is meats and fats, and is based on a lie. And I think that has been pushed and pushed and pushed for 50 years with no improvements. In fact, much worsening of our health status when it comes to diabetes and obesity in the United States. And countries in Europe that have adopted the FDA pyramid have now thrown it away because they see this problem.
Julie, as the registered dietitian here, what do you think about that?
So there's definitely some validity to, you know, what Dr. Sanders is saying. The food guide pyramid, you know, there is a lot of processed carbohydrates, you know, on the bottom. But that is not our standard. And, you know, we have not used the food guide pyramid. We now use what Dr. Rivari was talking about, the MyPlate, which is a much more balanced approach. Most of it's non-starchy vegetables. Again, you know, plant being plant strong. I like plant powered, too, by the way. You can add that to your vernacular, plant powered. Is that, you know, we really focus on getting more of those types of carbohydrates. So we really have done away with the food guide pyramid and really concentrated more on a balanced approach. And it is important to say, just, you know, back to Dr. Singh's approach, is that, you know, because of scientific evidence in the nutrition, you know, realm, there's a lot of cherry picking, what we call cherry picking of the data. And so, I mean, there is literally a Twinkie diet that shows, you know, you can lose weight on Twinkies. And so, we do want to focus on what a lot of the guidelines are based on now is really, to Dr. Singh's point, is the overarching mountain of evidence, you know, more like what she was mentioning, you know, Dr. Dean Ornish's, you know, research that literally proves reversal of heart disease on a low-fat, plant-based diet. Not only just reversal of heart disease, reversal of diabetes, reversal of prostate cancer, you know, and those kinds of evidence. You know, here we are 40 years strong. The long-term data is something. But, you know, again, we're open. Nutrition is still a very new science. And so we're learning more as we go. And so we really want to try to follow where the science leads us, and not be dogmatic about carbs are bad, fats are good, you know, this and that. Where does science lead us?
It seems like nutrition science is actually much more challenging to do research in, because, you know, other types of science and medicine, you can control, you know, everything, and then you introduce one variable in and you look for an outcome.
Absolutely.
But with people and what they eat, it's much harder, and it's not just, and as Dr. Singh was talking about, it's lifestyle. It's not just the food.
Absolutely.
So if you then have to factor in the differences in, let's say, their culture, whether they're more active, genetics, and then some of these studies, it's based upon just surveys and people
and food recall.
And food recall. What did I eat the last year? How much of this did I eat? And not necessarily observational studies. And so there's just inherent there's all this room for error, and then what we call confounding effects, where you can't tease out what was the cause. There might be an association, but maybe it had nothing to do with that specific food. But one of those studies that I think is very interesting is the study that was really responsible for this Mediterranean diet, which has gotten a lot of attention. In fact, I think it's probably the number one diet that's recommended by most nutritionists and healthcare practitioners and government agencies. Can you talk a little bit about the Mediterranean diet?
So the Mediterranean diet has gotten a lot of attention, you know, for its approach. It does introduce more fat than like a low fat, you know, vegan diet, you know, with the additions of some of the olive oils. It is still mainly plant-based, still lots of, you know, whole grains, but it does include some healthy animal fats like fish, you know, and that sort of thing. But what's different is what, you know, when we hear the Mediterranean diet here, most of the focus is on how much wine and cheese and that type of stuff. So the real Mediterranean, you know, diet was, you know, different. Their wine is different in the Mediterranean. How they grow their food is different. What their animals eat is different. So we talk about animal foods, and like you said, the quality of our meats are so important. We say we are what we eat, but we are what our animals eat as well too. So we were talking about bacon is different, you know, too, whenever it's how the animal was fed. Cows are different than how the animals fed. Our chickens, you know, those kinds of things. The quality of our food really needs to be the focus more than just the ratio of carbs and fats and proteins.
Would everyone agree, regardless of where you fit on the spectrum, whether you believe in a plant-based diet or more of a paleo or a ketogenic diet or a diabetic diet or a Mediterranean diet, I think, would everyone agree that you should be eating real food?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Definitely. Real food.
So processed food is
nothing processed.
Right.
Or minimal processed foods.
So then the trick is to define what is processed.
Something, right. Well, it should be food that your grandmother could recognize and that only has a few ingredients on the label. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay. We have a bunch of callers I need to get to. Let's see. We have Mitch from Natchitoches. Mitch, welcome to Health Matters.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can. What's your question?
Great. Hey, my question is I have type 2 diabetes. My doctor has recommended, he said I can get off my medicine if I just eat fruits, vegetables, and beans and exercise. Well, that sounds, and I'm trying to do that, but I like meat. Now, it's the first time I ever heard of this ketogenic diet. Well, my doctor explained it to me. What he said was, when I get fat in my body, it sort of keeps my body from accepting the insulin that it naturally produces. So how does this ketogenic thing work?
Okay. I'm going to direct that to Dr. Sanders. We actually have three other callers calling in, so we're going to try to answer
I'll
your question
briefly. So the way I would handle that, if someone came to me with a similar question, first of all, fruits would be very, very small quantities. That's a sugar, and fructose is that sugar, and that's probably one of the worst natural sugars around, the way it's handled by the body. So fruits would be very low. That we treat that as candy almost. I would say high in vegetables, and I use my vegetables as fat carriers. I put oils on my vegetables and cheese on the vegetables so I can carry more fat in. And then lots of meat, and I don't trim the meat. I agree with it being unprocessed and real food, uncured bacon, and food that you can. I have a friend who makes homemade sausage and things like this, where we're minimizing the processing. So I would say for type 2 diabetes, high fat, low carb diet, turn the faucet off, Keith.
Can I add one thing? Exercise, lifestyle modification, like he asked about the exercise. Your exercise is going to lower your insulin resistance. As you exercise and you know, do that physical exertion, you're going to open up alternative pathways to utilize that glucose and get that glucose into the cell and lower your insulin resistance. So make sure you're not just focusing on, yes, diet is one of the variables, but it's lifestyle modification. And that's what, you know, the American Diabetes Association and ACE is going to recommend, that you're going to work on your exercise, your diet, you know, stop smoking if you're smoking, limit your alcohol. You know, there's a lot of other things in behavioral modification to help overall. Just, you know, the diet is one part of that plan.
Mitch, thank you very much for that excellent question. We're going to go to Rhonda from Spring Hill. Rhonda, welcome to Health Matters. Hi, Rhonda.
Thank you very much. Hi. I've certainly enjoyed this forum, and one of the things that came to my mind as I was listening to the different types of diets, whether they're plant-based, whether they're the animal fat, or even the Mediterranean, is, you know, anything that we put in our body is going to change the pH. And so I'm thinking of the acid-base balance, because I do know with, you know, with cancers that they thrive in an acid, in a more acid environment. And also, you know, when you have too much protein, you run that risk of possibly gout. And I know that breeds a more of an acid environment. So if you're looking at, you know, a keto diet or a plant-based diet or even the Mediterranean, which of these would be a more of a neutral pH that would enhance a better health? And also, I wanted to mention the water. You know, we hear a lot about an alkaline water, and also that you want your body in a semi-alkaline state, you know, for better health. And so I'm wondering, of these three diets, which would be the best to decrease the inflammation that we all know that is so prevalent in coronary artery disease and also so many other disease processes?
Okay, Rhonda, thank you very much for your call. I think, Dr. Kimber Vary, I think I'd first like to address this whole notion of acid, base, changing your body's pH, because I think Rhonda's question was all predicated upon that being a valid statement. So can you address that first, please?
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, Rhonda, you'll just have to talk with your doctor and look at, you says, I don't know all of your other medical history, but, you know, you definitely want to balance. And in all of these different diets, it's not an easy question to answer right off the bat. But, you know, no matter what, I think all of the diets that we're talking about is limiting your carbohydrates and limiting the amount that you're putting in. So your body's going to be able to utilize that glucose. So I think that I don't know if anyone else has any other comments specifically.
How does diet affect the pH of your blood?
Well, it's an acid and base balance, and it has to do with the way that your body breaks down the carbohydrates. And you know, we have a neutral pH, and we don't I don't know if anyone else wants to add on.
No, actually, I don't think our pH changes near as much.
That's what I was getting at.
Obviously we have pH, and it changes sometimes with illness, with medication, right, with dehydration. Very, very little. We are adapted to incredibly tight control our pH.
I mean, our stomach will normally neutralize yes, that.
So, okay. So I do want to say that it is possible to eat in ways that promote less inflammation, I guess, and I hate to use that word because it sounds a little less scientific than it probably actually is. But I do want to say that as far as alkaline water goes, not a shred of evidence to spend money on alkaline water. Nowhere. And one thing that I would love to teach all patients, and anyone in fact, to ask is, when someone is trying to sell you something for your health and they're going to take your money, the question you need to ask is, I'm so glad you think you can help me with this. If you could just show me the long-term clinical outcome studies that show that not just is this going to quench my thirst, but that some outcome that matters, like cancer incidence or heart disease incidence or reversing my diabetes, that's the outcomes that we're looking for. So protect yourself from the alkaline water sellers.
Okay. So thank you. So, Rhonda, I hope that that answered your question. We now have Amelia calling back, and that's Amelia from Shreveport. Amelia, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I have a question for Dr. Sanders. My question is, how do you screen your patients that you would ask to follow the ketogenic diet, and how do you calculate the comorbidity effect that they may experience if they have a potential for high blood pressure or other issues? How do you address that and screen the patients that are appropriate to be on the ketogenic diet? And also, when you say that carbohydrates are not necessary in the diet, are you accounting for the micronutrients that are present in carbohydrates? And then how do you address the micronutrient deficiencies that could occur with hair loss, constipation, low blood pressure that are common with the ketogenic diet?
Fantastic questions, Amelia. Thank you so much. I'm going to put it to Dr. Sanders.
So first of all, we go through a pretty extensive screening, both of Tom Siskron and I both do this, and we draw a battery of labs, review their medications, and actually neither one of us make medication changes. We involve their primary care physician for that. We tell them and talk to their physician about that they're likely going to need much less diabetic medications and blood pressure medications for that matter. So those things are usually going to be needed less. So I don't think it would be a problem of increasing the comorbidities. We follow them. And this is, as Dr. Kimmel Rivari mentioned, I'm a huge fan of CrossFit. I'm a CrossFit L1 certified coach. And so exercise is a huge part of my life, and I try to get my patients to do the same. The other micronutrients, I'm not talking about eating zero carbohydrates. So, you know, you have a truckload of lettuce has a fraction of the carbohydrates that a donut has. And so if I eat lettuce and spinach and broccoli, which I do pretty much every day, and avocados, I'm picking up these micronutrients. So I think the micronutrient factor is minimalized significantly, if not obviated. And what was the third piece? I can't remember the third piece of that. I'm sorry,
Amelia, you still there with the third piece? I think she hung up. Micronutrients.
The micronutrients. You know, we're not talking about eating zero carbs. I mean, the carbohydrates I do eat, the foods I do eat that have carbohydrates are, they're just low on the carbohydrate scale. They, as I mentioned, you know, a cup of spinach is going to have a couple of grams of carbs or something, very minimal amounts of carbohydrates, and yet all of those micronutrients that are there.
Okay. This has been a phenomenal show. I asked my producer if we could stay for another hour because we have so many people trying to call in, and we just ran out of time, and there's like hundreds of questions that people have given me. So we're going to have to come back, and I thank everybody for being here, and I hope you're all willing to come back and continue this discussion because we just really scratched the surface. And such an important topic. So, I really appreciate everyone's assistance. Julie Hartley, our registered dietitian, Dr. Singh, our lifestyle medicine, Dr. Sanders, our ENT and plastic surgeon, who's a CrossFit coach, and as well as a ketogenic diet aficionado, and of course, Laura Kimball Rivari, our endocrinologist. So thank you all for coming and spending your time with us this evening. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Durlith, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Snell. Health Matters is for informational purposes only. For all health concerns, contact your physician or healthcare provider. Views and opinions expressed by guests on Health Matters may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and by the Knoll Foundation. This show will be available for podcasts at redriverradio.org. Tune in next Thursday for Health Matters Mental Health Edition. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and thanks again for joining us this evening.